You are about to witness history in the making. From the dawn of history, a better way of life has been man's dream. Make friends, grow bigger crops, get real smoking satisfaction, strengthen our national defense.
And it's all because of
LiveInTheStudio.tv.
Good evening and welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob. Denny Griffin here, and I'll be your host for the next hour. And if anyone would like to call in with a question or comment, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And if you're watching at liveatthestudio.tv and are in the chat room and you have a question or comment, you can text it. And we will certainly try to answer it for you. Tonight we're going to be talking about the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's strategy in going after the Tony Spilotro crew here in Las Vegas. And the FBI also was interested in Spilotro and had their own surveillance and activities they were conducting. And we're going to end talking about an incident that occurred on Metro's end on June 9th of 1980. And that was a police shooting of an individual named Frank Bluestein. So we'll get to that in shortly. But first, I'd like to introduce my guest tonight, former Metro undercover detective Louis D. Tiberius. Louis, welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Thank you, Dan.
And Louis, how many years do you have in the force, Lon?
Here in Las Vegas, I got 27 and a half, and I did almost 3 years in NYPD.
Oh, you're NYPD-er? I didn't know that.
Yep.
Okay.
So it made me go west.
Go west, young man.
Oh,
go
yeah.
So you had about 30 altogether, huh?
Yeah, about 30 years law enforcement. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. As long as you mentioned that, let me just ask you, what major difference did you see between the two PDs? I mean, obviously New York was a bigger city and so forth. And
well, back in those days, it was major, major differences.
Yeah.
I got on NYPD. I worked Brooklyn South. And you're in patrol for quite some time. And it takes a long time to get established. A lot of people, a lot of different precincts. I mean, the amount of cops in New York compared to what it was in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I got caught up in the layoffs in Las Vegas when Mayor Beam was there. So I actually got laid off the police department in New York, messed around a little bit looking for jobs, and the only economically sound city at the time with gambling and everything was Vegas. So I took my shot and came out here, tested and got on Metro.
And then 27 and a half years later?
Yeah.
When did you retire? It was not too long.
I retired about 4 years ago.
About four.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when I was writing this book, The Battle for Las Vegas, The Law versus the Mob, I talked to you, but you were still on the job then, so...
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
We,
a little reluctant to talk to you, but...
Sure, sure, understandable.
You got my attention, anyway.
Now, tonight... our second guest was to be Kent Clifford, former commander of the intelligence unit for Metro, and he ran into a snag. He's going to try to get here. Hopefully he will. If not, Louis and I will bravely go forward and cover everything we can. Louis, now, we're going to be leading up to the Bluestein shooting in June of 1980, and that came about as part of a surveillance Metro was doing at our pizza restaurant here in town that was owned by a couple of the mobsters, the so-called hole-in-the-wall gang.
Good friends of mine now.
Yeah, good friends. But that incident on June 8th, there was a lot of surveillance other than that. I mean, that was nobody got shot every time there was surveillance.
No. Well, it's hard to say there was a lot of surveillance just on that night. We always had surveillance. It's a general term. You know, talking about surveillance,
mm-hmm.
We had different squads. We have a lot of people out there working. Prior to that, we really focused in on the Spilotro group. And you're going after somebody like Tony Spilotro, especially with the FBI. His interest in Las Vegas at the time. That was the early days, and the FBI was still building up. So we were also part of their crew. They were part of our crew. And I don't know if we ever really got along with the FBI, but at that time, I think it was, let me put it this way, afterwards, when I continued working after the big Collada and Spilotro era, we really never had the kind of gel or contacts we had with the FBI like we did in the olden days. It was a lot more courteous and a lot more genuine to work with these people. They depended on us, and we depended on them. And for nothing else, they had the laws and the money, so they always be there for us.
They got a couple of good assets to have, right?
Oh, yeah.
But there had been a time, actually, in 78, when a couple of Metro detectives got nailed and got caught up in FBI. One of them was Joe Blasco.
My friend Joe, yeah.
For passing information on to Tony and his boys. That, I understand, put a little bit of a stress on everything because Metro was kind of had a black eye over it and wasn't trusted necessarily.
You know, they say timing is everything, but that's when I went up there. I went up there right after the Blasco. I went up there after Spilotro was established, and, things were already rolling. So I was the rookie, and later on, that was my nickname with Joe.
The rookie?
Yeah, through the hole-in-the-wall gang and all the stuff we did, I was known as the rookie.
It was a name you liked or didn't like.
No, I didn't bother me. We had nicknames for them. They had nicknames for us. And
so, but after, I think, when Sheriff McCarthy got in 79, he came in as a reform guy, reform candidate, and made a lot of change. In fact, he got sued right off the bat for some of his transfers of personnel. But he did declare war as one of his objectives.
So that's another weird time because everybody held their breath. And everybody, I think, was really shocked when McCarthy came in. Kent Clifford was supposed to be here today. Everybody was shocked when he made commander. Looking back on it, though, it's almost like astrology, because everything that took place in that era, in that time, even with the FBI, even with Metro, was everybody got in line. It was, to me, looking back, it was almost like a godsend. Again, timing is everything,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean, McCarthy came in and was not the typical police administrator and did different things differently. The people underneath him, he had a lot of trust, a lot of faith in. The Intelligence Bureau, which was now working organized crime, as well as the unions and everything else, Ken Clifford came in. He was promoted from, I think, a detective all the way up to captain, all the way up to commander, and there was a lot of controversy through that. Then a sergeant came up, Gene Smith. And we had a bunch of guys. I know the Hole in the Wall had their crew, some talented people, but we had our crew too, and we had a heck of a crew at that time. So it's like astrology, like the moon, the stars, the sun, everything just gotten in a line,
uh-huh.
and we were able to do stuff. Now I worked a lot of stuff after that, and we had some good people, but nothing like the old days, nothing like the era or that crew that we had that was really put together and well-trusted to go out there and do what we had to do.
So from that period through Tony's death, actually, when that kind of ended the Spilotro era, well, Yeah, then it's Spilatro area.
Tony
ended
the
Spilatro
area.
From the time they had the shake-up with McCarthy and so on, it seems that the working relationship, Metro regained the trust, I think, of with other agencies, national organizations, and so forth, and seemed to be a better working relationship then.
I think we did. The thing that I noticed, or the thing that was so wonderful about our crew, was that we were working internal. I know we were reaching out, working with Narcotics, Vice, and all the other divisions, usually in the police departments and at Metro at that time. You don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the NOCs don't like the organized crime guys. The Vice guys don't like the NOCs. But we had a pretty good gelling, and we had some great guys in all the divisions. We didn't have the jealousy and the ego problems of, a lot of departments, or I should say even Metro has. And, you know, I got to admit, I was so happy to leave.
When you retired?
So happy to leave. That's how the other way it went. It was a total, to me, it was a whole total 180-degree turn, you know. With the investigations, how we did things, and the politics was phenomenal.
Yeah, I've heard it was something.
Wow.
So now the law enforcement, Fed and local, recognizes that Spilatro is got to be gotten rid of, either put in jail or driven out of town or something has to happen. So there's an all-out effort from both agencies to get a full court press, I guess, is the term a lot of people use.
Again, going back to the crew, it's very difficult when you're dealing. You work more with your own administration than you work with the bad guys or trying to, you know, really trying to do your job. Under them circumstances, was just the opposite. We needed stuff, and they bent over backwards. I mean, there was a lot of people even at that time. So were you intelligence cops, you organized crime cops, you got it made, you do this, you make all the money, you do this. Truth is, I mean, we were putting our own money, our own gas money in the cars at that time. The crunches, we had budget crunches and everything, and half of the stuff we wanted to do, the administration would let us do. Of course, they had to deal with the budgets and everything, but they did it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a shutdown. They actually did it.
You had support.
So when you got guys, and I have to look back and just say, you know, did I know McCarthy? Yeah, I knew him. Not on a working relationship, not as well as the administrators would know him, but he was there. And Kent Clifford was there. And then you got people like Gene Smith. I mean, nothing in this town I don't think would have happened without this combination.
Mm-hmm.
Got a guy, the other side of our unit was Dennis Caputo. Stuff ain't going to happen, and you're not going to find these people around anymore. It just the training or the atmosphere of the police department, the way these people come up, it's not there no more.
So you think there's a downhill?
Oh, definitely a downhill after that. Oh, definitely, yeah.
And 4 years ago, you were ready to bail out.
4 years ago, we got to the point where there was no choice. We were basically pushed out.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Going back to the...
And it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
So you're happy now.
Oh, I'm happy now.
Going back to the Spilatro era, how many people were in your unit, the Intel unit? How big a unit was it?
Oh, God, I don't know. We must have had about 30 people, I think.
And how many per squad?
It was hard to say because we did mix match. We did a lot of stuff. Even when I went up there, I started out, when I first went up there, I think they really, some people saw me. I was working with Dave Gruber, and we were racking up a little bit in patrol. You know, we were doing a lot of work in patrol. And then somebody came and said, listen, think you want to work undercover? Sure, I'll give anything a shot. Have you ever done it? No. Okay, NYPD, you don't, you know, it takes 20 years before you get up. So Said, sure. So you go up there temporarily, and things worked out pretty good. But I went up into narcotics, because back then everything was under one umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
You know, intelligence, vice, narcotics. And from there, I went into the unions. I worked with them guys. I worked with vice. I worked with... And I was lucky enough to be accepted and stayed.
Now, my recollection from talking to Kent Clifford was that there was a certain hardcore crew that was assigned kind of full-time to the Spilatro investigation. Were you one of those?
That was us.
And there was only about six guys, maybe?
Yeah.
It was relatively small.
Yeah.
And then as more forces were needed for a specific assignment or something,
right,
you'd bring in other people temporarily.
Yeah. Everybody up in intelligence knew what was happening. You know, I mentioned Gene Smith. This was his squad. This was what he was doing. And again, if it wasn't for him, we would have never done this.
Gene Smith was a tough guy, wasn't he?
Very tough.
Is a tough guy.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I'd go to hell with him again.
Frank Collada told me that he actually thought he and Gene Smith were quite a bit alike in their dedication to what they were doing. I mean, different sides of the law, but he said Gene was a guy that would get things done. He was
committed.
Gene
was going to get things done. Mm-hmm. Gene was part of the crew. It's not like your boss or you got that middleman in between you, and you always got to watch your back, and you always got to. When you work with Gene Smith, somebody was watching your back no matter what, all the time. And the crew that we had was phenomenal. I mean, you know, the guys, everybody trusted everybody. Everybody was loyal. Everybody was, which brings us back to Frank's crew, which is actually part of the outfit and, you know, part of the code, part
mm-hmm.
of their family, their way of life, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have to really be blood Italian at street level, you know, crime, but... Gene Smith took us to a new level. Even at that time, I was undercover. And undercover was hit and miss. If I was needed someplace, I was out there. You know, if we were doing street stuff, pickups and everything. But we did a lot of stuff which we called the tower capers. These were sensitive stuff that would come down. Private meetings, private briefings, totally secret. One squad doesn't know what the other squad, unless they needed to know,
mm-hmm.
unless, we're going to use them. And we did a lot of that stuff. Even some of the surveillances were very, very secretive to the point, because so much political, so much, you know, we're out there doing stuff for other agencies all the time that we didn't want other agencies to know about.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would, you know, just off the top of my head, I remember we did a big thing on corruption through Miami PD. And the guys were coming out here partying. There's one thing about things that happen in other states. Sooner or later, they all come to Vegas to party. So we get the calls. You know, we get the calls, and it's like top secret stuff. And now, here you are sitting on another cop. You know. So, and you really don't know the whole story, so you just really got to do what you got to do and then let somebody else handle it. So you never – you get all the evidence. You do all the information and give it up, let them take it. But at that time, Gene Smith says, we're going to get serious about these guys. Because I remember we had this big, big briefing, and we went back and forth, and we came up. We were going to get into new technology. We were going to step it up, and we were getting into all this charts and graphs, and we were doing probability factors on people. We came up with Frank Collada.
That probability of...
That's the man we want. That's the guy we're going to go after in the Spilatro organization.
So you guys, going through your charts and graphs and analysis of everybody,
mm-hmm.
you came up with the idea that the best guy to go after, to target, was
would
Frank.
Be the lieutenant, yeah.
And he was, for people who aren't familiar with Frank, he was what they call a lieutenant. He was one of
the... He was the boss. He was the, he was the street boss.
He ran, and the burglary crew they referred to generally as the hole-in-the-wall gang.
Hole-in-the-wall gang, yeah.
And the hole-in-the-wall gang had various members at various times. In other words, apparently, if they were going to do a small job, one or two burglars might go on it. A major thing they could bring in.
Yeah. When you have a crew like that, well, just like us, we had our Spilatro crew, but around it, we had access to all the other squads, and everybody also had access to everything we were doing. And we were going out there reaching to patrol and everything because that's where we were getting information from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we would get phone calls all the time. Hey, one of your guys is driving down so-and-so. You were talking about surveillances before. That's when things would change. We'd get calls. Hey, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, get a call, get up. We got to go boom, boom, boom. Meet over here. We'd run down there. Who we on? Ernie DeVino. Ernie DeVino, why are we getting up 4 o'clock for Ernie? Because he's been up all night and he's going here and there. Burglary. Something's going. Where's Frank? Can't find him. It's Collada home? We don't know.
Yeah.
Then we go look for Leo. Then we go look. That's how the surveillance is. And we did them all the time. All hit and miss.
Let me just mention that you mentioned a couple of names. The hole-in-the-wall gang, Frank Collada was the field supervisor, street boss of the gang. And he had actually assembled a lot of these guys and put them together as the crew. They worked generally under Spilatro. He was kind of the big...
Tony was the capo, yeah.
And then you had involved, you had Leo Guardino, who was an accomplished thief.
Leo Guardino.
Frank was... Would you call him a master thief? I guess he...
I think Frank would be a master thief, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because he would do robberies, burglaries, scams,
anything.
Whatever it took, yeah.
Yeah. Guardino wasn't noted very much for violence, was he? He was more of a thief.
Burglar. He's a good burglar, or...
How about
how do you rate a burglar? I guess he was a good burglar. Took a long time to get caught. So
how about Ernie DeVino? Was he primarily a burglar, or thief, or was he
Ernie's muscle burglar, all around. General. This is what we need done.
Okay.
I would see Ernie doing a lot more errands type stuff and pick this up or do this and go talk to people.
But he'd rough
especially
people
up. Especially go
talk
to
people.
If he had to, he'd rough them up. We've had our chats. We've had our incidences. And these guys aren't that tough. Look at little me. They're not that tough.
And they had, actually what I'm naming is the crew that was together for the Bertha's job, which is going to be another separate show. But you also had a guy named Wayne Metecky.
Wayne's not a local guy, though.
No, he's Chicago, right?
He's a Chicago guy, yeah.
And now, when I saw a picture of him, I thought he looked like a computer geek professor or something. Yet he was a killer, too, wasn't he?
His reputation was supposed to be pretty tough. Martial arts and some other stuff, so...
And you wouldn't know
and
him by looking
at. And he's well-trusted, and... for somebody like Frank to be utilizing people like this, yeah, it's just like us. Again, the parody is remarkable, but Gene Smith's crew and Frank Collada's crew, if you go man for man and match everybody, that's what you would get. And if we had to bring in other people, that's what he'd do. We would sit there with Gene and say, hey, listen, we need to do this. Hey, you know who's good at this? Joe Blow from Vice is really good at making the... Call him. Get him over here. Let's see. We'll borrow him for a week or two and see what happens. Frank would do the same thing. Frank could call Chicago, maybe even California. Because they had people out there, too.
So there was manpower available.
Oh, yeah.
Needed.
Depending on what he wanted to do, yeah.
Another guy who doesn't get mentioned all that often, a guy named Larry Newman.
My friend. Another good friend.
Old buddy of yours.
You're hitting them all.
And Larry was not only a thief, he was the son of a gun, wasn't he? A killer.
Larry's a cold-blooded psycho killer.
Yeah.
Psychotic, yeah.
And
his reputation surpassed him. And to be in a crew like that, Larry would do what he had to do. And I could see him being in that crew if you need these kind of specialists. So if you're gonna, yeah, if you're gonna do robberies or strong arms, if you need a guy with a gun, if you need somebody killed,
Larry's your man.
The psycho. They used to call him Lurch, I think.
Lurch, huh?
Big Lurch, yeah.
Big Lurch. And I counted when I was doing my research for the books, 6 that he killed. We know.
Oh,
I don't know how many more there were. And in some cases, he did it just because he liked it, it seemed. There was really not necessarily a dire need.
I think he actually had to be controlled. I think he would be that type of person. So if I was the capo, if I was the, if I was Tony Spilotro, I would be concerned and make Frank aware that you better keep control of this guy because he could bring a lot of heat on you.
Yeah.
And he's the type of guy. I mean, he'd go kill people for the sake of killing them. You know, whereas the family and everybody else, there's a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a purpose to what they did.
And you, in fact, had to testify at a court proceeding, federal court, when Newman for sentencing.
I testified against Newman once or twice, I think. Twice.
Did Larry ever say talk to you when you were?
Oh, he threatened me in court.
What did he say?
Federal court, yeah.
What did he say?
Well, it was during a time period when we were going, you mentioned Joe Belasco, too. We were coming up with a lot of information that they had on us. Belasco still had a lot of connections. We were finding out that they not only had some of our radio frequencies, but actually knew what we were driving, knew where we lived. Larry made that perfectly clear to me.
No.
He knew where, oh, yeah, he knew where I lived and my kids and what school and all that stuff. And some of the stuff that we found was true. They had paperwork and they had a lot of stuff on us. So it was a little, you get that a lot, especially working organized crime or working the political end of things. You get that a lot and you get a lot of threats and you take it with a grain of salt. You mentioned Larry as a psycho killer. He scared me.
So when he told you,
I think if he ever got out, I would be nervous.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Judge Pro. So long ago, but with the prosecutors and with the judges and everything, we were saying it. You know, if this guy ever gets released from jail, we want to be notified. We have to be notified because I don't think he'll, you know, he's sitting in jail. He's keeping names and keeping...
making his plans.
Oh, yeah. If he ever got out, I would be worried about him.
So he's the kind of guy that you could take seriously.
Absolutely.
Not idle threats.
Yes.
Okay. And then Joe Blasco, he had been fired after being caught up and given information. So he was working overtly now with these guys doing different things.
Yeah, I was the new guy. I was the new guy coming up, and I bought some drugs, and I did this, and I'm working undercover, and I got this heavy New York accent, and I'm really cool and all this. And some of the old-timers, some of the steady rock guys up there who accepted me, I mean, wonderful people, were very close to Joe. So it was, you know, the new squads and the new stuff we were working in, and this is all during the conversion period, too. And at that time, we were doing political. We were doing political corruption and political crimes, which was very new for Las Vegas, too. And we had Denny Caputo's squads who were working some real secret stuff, some heavy-duty stuff. And, again, undercover, we got lent out. We work with them. They work with us. We, you know, share information. That was our primary job, was to gather as much information as we could, feed it off to the Fed, Chicago, you know, although... You got to be careful what you gave Chicago, especially at that time. But
so now you guys have decided Frank's your target. He's the guy you really want to go after.
Yeah.
Now, Frank.
Now, the conversion was overt.
Overt. You want to let them know
overt.
That you're there.
This is Gene. I don't know what I could say on this radio, but
go ahead.
We're going to go and spend time with these people. And that's what we did.
And they're going to know. You're there.
Oh, they're going to know who we are and what we're doing.
Okay.
And it's in the face. Everything's right in the face with these people.
Now, that led, it not only probably put pressure on them, knowing somebody was always there.
The heat's there.
The heat's there.
That's the general, the bottom line. And the heat's going to be there. You can't attack him here. You can't catch him. It's hit and miss. Everything's hit and miss. But if you stick with him as much as possible, you're going to interfere with their schedule.
Mm-hmm.
They got to plan stuff. I mean, you know, you got to master burglar. He's not just going to go out and, you know, he's got to bring in. He's got to earn. You know, he's got to show Tony, too, that he's worthy of the Las Vegas stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to work him, but we had other stuff to do. Frank ran a street crime unit, but he had other stuff to do. If stuff came down from Chicago to Tony, who's he going to use? The most trustworthy, the most, he's going to use his own crew.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank had other stuff to do, too.
So he had stealing and then other priorities.
Oh, yeah.
Priorities
oh, yeah.
Came
but
in from
the stealing and everything. I mean, they got to earn. They got to make the money.
Yeah. That was their income, right?
Yeah. So Gene knew this. We knew that. So as much as we could stick with him and interrupt that and maybe catch him in the act, maybe do something.
Mm-hmm.
So
if not, you're at least going to put the pressure on.
Put the pressure on him.
And maybe they make a mistake under stress.
If we don't get him, we'll get somebody else.
Yeah.
If we get somebody else, maybe we could twist him.
Now, Frank told me that when he first got in town, he and Leo Guardino teamed up, and their first three scores, the first three burglaries, they used the proceeds to buy the upper crust pizza parlor. So they were
no
partners.
Doubt in my mind whatsoever.
And that became a hangout, obviously. Frank was a part owner.
Yes.
And so that was a likely place where you'd want to spend some time or sit in the parking lot or whatever and see who was in and out. And
oh, we were on the upper crust all the time.
So
the
that,
upper crust into my place.
Into
my place,
place
was right next door to the upper crust.
There was
you
a bar.
Know that.
A bar, right?
Yeah, you wrote a book about it. You
yes,
know.
Yeah, my place in the upper crust. And so a surveillance of the upper crust, let's just talk about the upper crust now, when you're putting the heat on Frankie and the
yeah.
guys. How long would a tour last? How long would you sit?
Oh, hours.
Hours on end.
Oh, yeah, if we didn't have other stuff to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd sit for hours. You take runs. You run by John's house, run by Tony's house, go, you know, run by Leo.
Mm-hmm.
And even hit some of the things got boring. So you'd hit some of the hotels to see what cars, you know, you kind of knew where some of the money people, like the bookmakers and the, you know, where they hung out and where, and you're just trying to catch people. And you had the other side of the coin. You had Lefty floating around too.
Rosenthal.
Yeah, Lefty yeah. Rosenthal, and you had the all the book people. And we knew where they were hanging out. We knew where the drops were. We knew where, you know, people were going to be seen and stuff. You make the cruise. You see the same people all the time. No big deal. Business as usual. You see a new car. You see a new face. You want to hang around.
Sure.
You want to see who's going where, who's, you know, who's doing what. And if you pick up on anybody, you call it in.
Did you ever have any people surprise you by showing up at these places? Was there ever anybody that bopped in that you had, wouldn't expect to have seen in the upper crust or in my place?
Oh, God, that's so hard. Well, I want to say yes and no, because I always was hoping and expecting to see or find somebody. We mess with them people. I mean, they would go to dinners, and we would show up and walk right in, sit at the bar and sit at tables next to them, and they knew who we were. Oh, and we got, I have to admit it, we got great joy out of upsetting their attorneys.
Harassment.
Police
harassment.
We're now in the political arenas.
Did these guys ever blow their cool any time when
oh,
you were
yeah.
pressured, did they?
Oh, sure.
Well,
Tony never did, though. Tony always gave you the stare.
Oh, the death stare?
The death stare. Tony yeah. was the death stare, but his brother John. John would lose it a lot.
Yeah. Did
Victor, you could sit down and talk to Victor. Tony's brother, Victor.
Okay. Give me an example of what an altercation might be like if you went, these guys go in a restaurant, you guys decide to bust their chops, and you go in and take a table next to them. What type of comments might go back and forth, or hand gestures possibly, or whatever?
It'd be as simple as going to the, well, if you're in proximity, you're going to the bar, you order a drink, sit at the bar and turn around and just stare at them. And just smile, just laugh, just whisper at each other.
Uh-huh.
There's a guy named Jack Tighe was part of our crew. And Jack knew how to irritate the people, too. And there's a few things I never even knew what he was saying. He'd walk by him and say stuff to him and whatnot. And next thing you know, the people are standing up and flaring. And
you know how to get their goat, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Did anybody ever actually get punched out on either side?
No.
Or was,
no.
Okay, but
no.
Tempers used to flare, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah, they would flare. I mean, you're not gonna punch a detective and get, you know. There's so many games being played all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Frank would come out and flip us off all the time. You know, we'd go and pretty sure it was Joey Cusimano's car. Was always, every time he was there, he'd put a cover over his car.
A cover?
Yeah, a car cover. So we used to go take it off. We got to see who it is.
Yeah.
Which is plate. And pretty sure he got pretty upset and took a big magic marker and put his plate number on the outside of the cover. So we,
you know what?
But we took it off anyway.
Okay, getting to the night of June 9th, 1980, you were working that day.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your assignment originally that day? Do you remember?
General. We're doing general assignments. I was with Groover that night.
Dave Groover.
He was involved in the shooting.
Yes.
And I was going to go with another detective from another squad because we were working the junkets, hotel junkets. The hotel junkets used to fill in other mob guys. They used to sneak in under different names. And so part of our assignments were to, you know, make friends in the hotels and go down there and check out our people and see who's coming in, who's going, and all that. Mm-hmm. So I left that night. And Gene Smith came down and was hanging out with Groover when doing a surveillance on the upper crust when that came.
Okay.
And that's a normal, wow, new car. A new car, new guy, they're talking, they're friendly. Ooh, who is he?
Yeah, this guy wasn't known.
I don't know if any, we knew the Bluesteins. I mean, we knew the family, but I don't think we ever knew or did anything with Frankie.
Let me, but had it not been for going on your junket
I would have been there with Dave, yeah.
You would have been involved in this thing.
I would have been there with Dave, yeah.
Okay, let me...
And if we had time, we probably would have had another car or maybe had... Depends on the communications. It was a slow... I'm pretty sure that it was so long ago, but it was a slow night. It was just a laid-back, casual type night.
I want to tell you, I talked to David Groover and Gene Smith when I researched my book,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to read a few of the things they told me. But I want to say, I did a presentation this past February, just a few weeks ago, Las Vegas, and my presentation at a cultural center. And we had a question and answer session after the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people in the audience, and I don't know who he was, I never got a name, it wasn't important, but
yeah.
He obviously, well, it appears to me he was either a Bluestein relative, family friend, someone who doesn't like the police, but it was obvious where he was coming from.
There's a lot of people who don't like the police.
that June 9th, 1980 still has some controversy. And
somebody died. Of
yeah.
course it does. Yeah.
And people with some
attitude.
It was
a tragic night, yeah.
So, at any rate, I'm going to read an excerpt from my book and when I interviewed Dave Groover and Gene Smith. And the evening of June 9th, Groover and Smith were conducting a routine surveillance of the Spilotro gang. And that night they were camped outside the Upper Crust Pizza Parlor and the adjoining My Place Bar located at Flamingo Road and Maryland Parkway. Tony's pal, Frank Collada, was part owner in the Upper Crust, and the Upper Crust and the bar had become regular hangouts for mobsters. Collada, Spilotro, and some of their associates were inside the Upper Crust, but nothing exciting was going on, for the two veteran cops had all the makings of another uneventful shift. We put in a lot of long, tedious hours watching those guys. When that kind of work, things could change very quickly, and that night they did, Dave Groover said in 2003. The changes began when a 1979 Lincoln with Illinois license plates pulled into a parking space in front of the Upper Crust. Spilotro, Collada, and another associate were now sitting at a table outside the restaurant. The operator of the vehicle went inside the eatery apparently to order a pizza to go, then came back out and joined Spilotro and the others at the table. They talked for several minutes until the new guy's pizza was ready. At that point, he got back in the Lincoln and drove away. The detectives weren't sure who this new player was, but it was obvious he was acquainted with Tony. Smith and Groover decided to follow the Lincoln to see what information they could gather about who he was and what he was up to. So far, this would be nothing out of the ordinary. You've got a new player, Lincoln, Chicago, Illinois plates, unknown apparently, and you want to find out who he is.
Sitting on a surveillance, you're pretty glad something happened, something came up, you know.
So, continuing with Dave Groover, as soon as he pulled out onto Flamingo, he started speeding, doing 80 or better and driving recklessly. I was driving our unmarked car, and Gene Smith was in the passenger seat. It's my understanding that the car was, in fact, unmarked, and according to the gentleman who raised the issue at the Cultural Center, he termed that it was a cold car and that it had our Arizona license plates on it. Would that be... Something could happen in Arizona.
Oh, we had I had a whole box full of license plates.
Okay.
We used to do that all the time. But again, they knew what we had.
Okay.
So we used to change all the time.
Okay. Eventually, we figured we had enough probable cause and the traffic violations to pull the car over and check out the driver. By that time, we were on McLeod near a new housing development called Sunrise Villas, and the Lincoln had slowed to the speed limit. I put the red light on the dash and activated it for the guy to pull over. The Lincoln turned into Ingresso, the street running into the development, went past an unmanned security booth, and stopped several yards beyond. I parked behind him, got out of the car, and approached the Lincoln, verbally identifying myself as a police officer and displaying my badge. As I neared the other car, it pulled away at slow speed, stopping again a short distance away. I got back in our car and followed, angling the police car in, and again getting out and approaching the Lincoln. This time, Gene got out and took up a position by our passenger door. Now, at that time, Groover and Smith did not know the Lincoln was being operated by Frank Bluestein, also known as Frankie Blue, a 35-year-old maitre d' at the Hacienda Hotel and Casino, which was one of the properties controlled by the Chicago outfit. It was part of Glick's package that he bought. And his father, Bluestein's father, Steve Bluestein, was an official in the local culinary union. And, in fact, his house had been searched in a 1978 search warrant by the FBI of the Tony Spilotro investigation. So the feds, at least, felt that there was some connection between Steve Bluestein, the father, and Tony.
Oh, there was definitely a connection between Steve and Tony Spilotro.
Okay. Continuing with Dave Groover, this time as I neared the Lincoln, the driver lowered his window. I again identified myself and displayed my badge. Suddenly, Gene hollered, "Watch out, Dave, he's got a gun." I returned to our car and took up a position behind the driver's door. Gene and I continued to yell at the guy that we were cops and to put his gun down. He started to get out of the car. The gun was still in his hand and aimed toward Gene. Believing the guy was about to shoot, Gene and I opened fire. At approximately 11:45 p.m., shots rang out. Several rounds struck Bluestein. He was rushed to a nearby hospital where he died a couple of hours later. A .22 handgun was recovered at the scene, but as far as the Bluestein family, Tony Spilotro, and attorney Oscar Goodman were concerned, this was not a justified use of deadly force. It was a police execution with the cops planting a gun on their victim to add legitimacy to their actions. It was a time that Dave Groover will never forget. There was a real firestorm over the Bluestein shooting. We were accused of murdering the guy, planting a gun, and all that stuff. We ran a check on the gun Bluestein had and traced it to his brother, Ronald. The gun had been purchased in Chicago. That pretty much blew the planted gun charge out of the water. We didn't release the information right away, though we waited until the coroner's inquest to make it public. Less than 2 weeks later, a coroner's jury ruled the death of Frank Bluestein to be a case of justifiable homicide. The cops were okay in that regard, but the verdict didn't prevent the filing of numerous civil suits against them. One was a $22 million whopper accusing the cops of violating Bluestein's civil rights. All of the cases were eventually decided in favor of the police, but the civil rights suit dragged on for 5 years. As the civil actions were being filed, Groover and Smith knew they had acted appropriately and were confident they would prevail. Other than the annoyance of dealing with the lawsuits, they weren't overly concerned. But they learned a few months later that whatever was being done to them by the Bluestein family's attorneys was the least of their worries. The gentleman who was at Winchester and alleged that this, in fact, had been a police execution. And we had just watched a clip of this from the movie Casino. In Casino, the scene depicting...
Casino?
Yeah, the Casino. They show a guy getting out of his car holding a foil-wrapped hero sandwich.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And two undercover or plainclothes cops are there, and they tell the guy to put the... They think it's a gun. They tell him to put it down. He doesn't.
Right.
And they open fire on him, kill him. Then when they walk up to the guy, they realize he was only holding a hero sandwich, so somebody gets a drop piece, and they plant a gun. And that's how the movie portrays it. obviously, that wasn't quite the case, although people may still dispute the police account. The gun, there was no question, it was traced to Ronald Bluestein. And what I found to be compelling was a man who was no friend to the police at that particular time was Frank Collada. He was an adversary. And he told me that when they were at that table that night, well, Bluestein was waiting for his pizza to be prepared.
You're going to say that Frank